Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 3, Episode 7, titled The Bear and the Maiden Fair. I have no idea why it's titled this.
Me either.
I couldn't tell you.
Some complex allegory involving
yes.
the Westerosi struggle for democracy against the oppression of tyranny.
The oppression of Tyrion?
Tyrion.
Oh, shit.
Tyranny. Yes, tyranny. it's the worst form of government of all.
What do you think of this episode?
I've liked wet shits better than...
Oh, God.
It's a good episode. You know what's funny is, like, I remember having a lot of harsh opinions about the titular Bear and Maiden Fair showdown in this episode, and as I was watching, I was bracing to just be like, see shitty CG or like bad choreography, or I mean, maybe that scene in the book is just a fucking barn burner or bear burner or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I found it amazing that I was, I guess, really strongly disappointed in the scene. So I haven't read that scene in the books for many, many years. And like I said, maybe it was like, it was just a real hellacious set piece, but, I thought it was good.
Yeah, it was fine. I think they used a real bear for that scene. So.
They did use a real bear.
Yeah. The only CG would be like compositing, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to interview Gwendolyn Christie about working with that particular bear way back when. If I can dig up that interview, I'll post it, because why the fuck not?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, this is a good episode with a decent amount of character development, some very difficult to watch things and unfortunate to watch things, and maybe more so if this has been your second time through the series and you kind of know what's coming. But yeah, it's also kind of like more of a moving things around episode too, setting
Absolutely.
Things up, like getting Arya from the Brotherhood to the Hound, getting Dany, advancing her plot line as she continues her campaign against Slaver's Bay. Moving Rob into position where he needs to be to meet with Walder Frey and continue his campaign. But for all that, it's still entertaining.
Yeah, I thought it was good. It's hard to really say that this is one of the better episodes of the season, coming off the back of so many really, really
right.
good episodes.
Right.
I think this was, things that needed to happen, but stuff that isn't very exciting. The bear scene, I mean, it's exciting in the moment. It's not exciting in the way that I think of Game of Thrones exciting, where
sure.
Littlefinger and Varys are scheming against
each other,
where, Tywin and Olenna are facing off in the court of politics. I don't know. It's an okay episode to me.
Okay.
It's probably, in a weaker season, it would have been a much better episode.
Yeah, right.
But this is such a strong season.
Yes.
So the contrast is there. Should we get started with the recap?
Why not?
Oh, I did notice that Michelle MacLaren directed this one,
hmm.
which is a staple of Game of Thrones and other show directing.
And of course, also we got a new location this week on the big map. Young
the
guy.
Windmill. Oh,
yes, the wind. It would have been funny if they'd put the
right.
The King's Windmill or whatever on the map to show you. Because I'm kind of curious exactly. Jon says a week's march away from Castle Black. That's that's a good amount of ways, especially overland and not on a road. So I kind of would like to know exactly where they are along the wall. That'd have been a cool detail to add. But
yeah, so it seems like they went over the wall and they're traveling kind of parallel to the wall
yeah.
to get to Castle Black.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, before we get on to the recap proper, just want to let everyone know what's going on at Bald Move this week. We are still working our way through Better Call Saul Season 4. That's a current season and like this rewatch. And we're doing instant talks on Monday night, and which means if you're a club member, you can actually tune in after the first airing on the East Coast and jump in our chat channel and interact with us live. Get your questions and comments answered on the air. Of course, we're doing the Game of Thrones rewatch. We're also wrapping up Sharp Objects next week. We might have actually a wrap-up podcast after that. I've really enjoyed watching the show. And next week is the final episode. We also did a little bit of Castle Rock discussion on the Bald Move television feed. That's where you'll find that, the Bald Move TV podcast. We are releasing a Few Good Men podcast next week. It's one of our commissioned podcasts. Great movie. Had a lot of fun podcasting about it. We also are seeing the movie The Little Stranger next week, which is a gothic ghost story that's coming out. That will be in a Bald Movies feed. And don't forget, on twitch.tv/baldmove, every 4 p.m. at Eastern Standard Time on Tuesday and Thursday, Jim and I are getting on there, and we got a new format that we're kind of digging so far, where we're watching a different kind of cheesy 80s era movie. We did Tremors, we did the last or Flight of the Navigator, and this Thursday we're doing Cloak and Dagger. And if you go to twitch.tv/baldmove, there's a 14-day archive where you can watch all of our back catalog up to 14 days. And if you're a club member, you can also see them anytime you want on our website, baldmove.com. That's what's going on at that there, baldmove.com.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Okay, let's get into the first scene here. John explains the methods of war south of the wall to Ygritte while she teases him about it. And then Aurel tells John he's going to lose Ygritte because he doesn't understand that people do things only when it suits them. This episode, I liked Aurel less and less, although I started to understand him a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know, later on we find out essentially he's in love with Ygritte and
right.
And is super jealous of John for that.
Yeah, no, and everything he was saying, I was kind of like, do I agree with, like, you know, the thrust of his argument? And I guess this is where, like, I square the difference between being a pessimist and an optimist, because, like, I do agree that that's fundamental human nature, that we're humans or we're animals and put against their backs to the corner, we'll lash out at anyone and everyone. But I think that's also like an obligation for a just society to engineer scenarios where people aren't forced into those corners and don't turn on each other. Because like when it suits them, when life is going good, everyone kind of loves each other and works together, and everything is easier and better. So Oral's not wrong. He's just not have the benefit of, you know, living in any kind of non-shithole situation.
Yeah. I don't know if the North is going to give him the non-shithole situation.
I don't know the
for.
Westeros in. The Westeros is not a great place on the balance to live unless you are a high lord or lady.
Yeah.
And even then, you better be on the right side of whatever is currently going on in the kingdom.
Mm-hmm. All right, then we go over to Catelyn worrying that Walder Frey is going to see the marriage of his daughter to Edmure as a slight, but Rob is there to remind her that Edmure is the best marriage the Frey house has ever had. And then he goes and he bangs Talisa, which the irony here, just the pure, I don't know, there's something delicious about saying, give Edmure, he's great, and then he goes off and does whatever the fuck he wants with his love life. And when they're done, Rob tries to plan his war, but Talisa is just looking too good. She's in the nude, he's totally distracted, and then he abandons planning altogether when she tells him she's pregnant.
I did enjoy, in the way that men do, her lying there with her feet laced together, like her toes. It was a striking image.
Sure, I can see why he's distracted,
writing her mother and all that. But it's a sad commentary in the King of the North that he is just brushing off all of these very valid political questions, and you kind of wonder like maybe if Talisa were slightly less hot or Rob is slightly more focused, they wouldn't arrive a day late.
Mm-hmm.
But Rob's like, hell, I got a warm bed and it's shitty out there, and I'm going to lay with my new queen. It's not a great look.
And I know, okay, Rob looks like a man full grown. He looks like a man who might be 30 years old in these scenes.
Yeah.
He's supposed to be like 16, right, in the books?
Yeah. A boy, sure.
I think when you keep that in mind, you can kind of forgive it. Like, he's playing much younger than he actually looks, I think. And so, you know, he might be distracted. He might be privy to or susceptible to the whims of his.
Although it's funny you say that, because, like, I've seen people in their mid-20s and 30s get completely Twitter-pated and make bad decisions. Hell, I've seen people in their late 60s and 70s get Twitter-pated and make bad decisions. Like, it is something that I don't know that you outgrow. It's more, it's like maturing isn't necessarily about an age. It's more of experience and wisdom that hopefully comes with it.
But I think 16-year-olds
are not going to have
characteristically not great at judgment.
Sure, they've got zero
especially
experience
when it comes to sex.
Zero experience, zero wisdom, and 110% hormones. So no surprise there.
It's understandable. It's still so stupid.
Right. There's a lot of gratuitous sexual nudity. There is at the beginning of the episode, it's like, okay, well, you know, you got King Rob and he's got the nice ass and Talisa, but then it just like the hits kept coming.
Mm-hmm.
So, but good for Richard Marsden or whatever his name is for bearing that kingly ass.
Tormund would know what to do with all the gratuitous nudity in
episode. That's right.
As he advises Jon how to fuck a woman, then Oral professes his love to Ygritte and tells her that she won't like Jon when she finds out what he really is.
Did we mention that Talisa was pregnant last scene? Because I feel like because like if you haven't watched the show, that's a big detail that we might have glossed over. I like Tormund, and in the book, he is very much comic relief, and he's well known for like making these vulgar statements and then giving a hearty har. And I liked how they kind of included that aspect of his character here. You know, he's humping his backpack and he's talking about how I don't know.
It feels like a very different Tormund than we see the first time we meet him.
Right.
Where Jon tries to bow to him as the king beyond the wall here.
Right.
It's good. And Aurel is just, Oral, I don't know how you say that, is stirring up so much shit. I do understand why he's being such a shit to Jon. He's jealous, A, that Jon is prettier than him, but also that he's stolen.
He's a walking forever alone meme.
Yeah.
And You know, that's the thing. It's like, oh, you think pretty will make you happy? And Ygritte's like, it's one of the things.
Got all the other things, too.
I also like the bravery and loyalty and all that. But, yeah, it doesn't help that he's very, very pretty, too. Like, yeah. I don't know. That's nice guy. Or I'll just stop with the nice guy shit. Need to give up. You need to go find. You need to stop getting. You need to stop spending all your time inside that fucking crow, and widen out, man. Widen out, or the eagle, or whatever the hell it is. You got bird brain.
All right, move on to Sansa, who can't believe how stupid she was to want to come to King's Landing. Marjorie's there, and she tells her to make the best of her circumstances. Though Sansa finds that hard when she thinks of what her and Tyrion's children might be like. And then Marjorie just blows Sansa's mind by telling her that Tyrion's proliferate sexual encounters with women might somehow be a good thing for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's... And, like, you know, Marjorie's almost like, you sweet summer child. Of course my mother taught me. Well, how else would I have gotten all of this information and experience?
Definitely not learned by fucking...
Yeah, yeah. Poor Sansa. Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. You wonder when she's going to hit rock bottom because, and that's the reason that I could never fully hate Sansa after like the first season is because she sees and appropriately blames herself for a lot of the things that happen. Like, you know, instead of just getting out the first opportunity, I decided to go for the brass ring of Loras and now I'm just a stupid girl with stupid dreams that never learns.
Which is a paradox, I feel. She says she's stupid. She says she never learns, but she learned that she's stupid. So
that's true. That's true. And if she was an android on Star Trek, her brain would just melt at the paradox. But but still, I mean, she's still snotty and stuck up. And like I thought, Marjorie was good trying to get her to make lemonade from all these lemons. Like, you know, Tyrion's not the worst Lannister. Has he ever been personally mean to you? And yeah, if Sansa thinks back, actually he's been quite nice, and he was a large part of my shield when I was under the lash of Joffrey. But he's a dwarf and he's got a fucked up face and he's a Lannister. Like I get all the reasons why Sansa would be less than enthused at this match, but
sure,
like Marjorie said, you know, like if you can get through it, however you define it, like, and you have children with this man, then they're going to be wealthy, powerful people, and you'll in all likelihood eventually make your way back to your home, and you know the Starks will still be kind of in winter. I'm not buying it myself.
No, I mean, this is the best part of the scene though, because it if you weren't already onto the Tyrell plan, now you fully understand it, right? Marjorie says, look, I'm going to sacrifice myself. I'm going to be Joffrey's bride, but I'm going to get to teach the kids. And the Tyrells will own the throne a generation from now.
Right.
Like, they are playing the long game where everybody else is playing the
Joffrey's
short game.
An idiot. He's not going to... No. He's not going to bother himself. So, like, they'll essentially culturally assimilate the Lannister regime into the Tyrell regime. And it's a long... But it's funny because, like, it really shows the difference between Marjorie, who is a political opportunist, and Sansa, who is a stupid girl with stupid dreams. Like, Sansa really believes all that courtly shit. Marjorie only does in so much as it gets her closer to what she wants. Like, she sees, this is the system I'm born in. How can I maximize the things that I can bring to this system to get me the highest score in the game? And Sansa just sees the system, but actually sees a false, you know, she buys the sales and marketing of that system. Even as little as one episode ago.
We'll see how that plays out for her. We go over to Bronn, who is having a lot of trouble sympathizing with Tyrion's plight, given that Sansa is so young and beautiful. He says, look on the bright side, Tyrion. You're going to have two women and a whole kingdom to rule over once he and Sansa have a child. What's not to love? But Tyrion doesn't really see it that way.
These are two mirrors, because like Marjorie's trying to talk Sansa into Tyrion, and Bronn's trying to talk Tyrion into Sansa.
Yeah.
It's a weird scene because they're like, at this time, I think Sophie was actually 15, maybe 16. And in the book, she's supposed to be like, you know, 13, 14. So they're essentially talking, you're talking this man into deflowering a child. And,
yeah,
you know, to modern ears, that's, that sounds very, very disturbing. And I guess Tyrion is the good guy for, like, you know, trying to put up a fight and trying to, you know, be the advocate for Sansa's feelings in the matter. And mm-hmm. But there's also the Shay thing that's wrapped up to it. And, you know, that's just, I just have a hard time with Shay.
I do too. There's going to be a scene later on where,
yeah,
we'll probably discuss
it's
that.
It's so hard to discuss, like, the stuff like this, like, but the thing is, like, I had a lot of antipathy towards Shay before I was a book reader, before I kind of knew things were coming. It just, like, always seemed like the problem was that they never were, like, any kind of what you'd call evenly yoked. Like, they didn't really want the same things. They didn't have the same, in, like, things that were important to them and family and culture. And it was just it was an ill match, and you wonder, like, how much of it was just the fact that Tyrion has not experienced what he would consider genuine love very often, and Shay showed that to him, or at least did the thing that the sex workers do and made you believe it, and he just fell for it hook, line, and sinker. It's arguably his biggest flaw. The fact that he's this gaping hole that needs love and affection that he never has gotten from his family or from his lovers, and he can be manipulated so easy by anyone that shows him that respect or love or loyalty or appreciation.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, a person in his position, who he is, there's not a lot of opportunity to explore the idea of love in his life, right? Because he's going to be married either out of spite or in order to secure some castle somewhere, some lands or some favor. Like, that's his fate. Oftentimes in that world, people don't get married out of love.
Right.
More often than not. And so, like, you know, Marjorie's talking about how there's not a lot of opportunity for women to experience sexual experiences.
To go sexual shopping and see what you like.
Right, but also there's no opportunity for anyone to experience love either.
Right.
The men at least get the benefit of boning and sampling all their desires there, but no one gets to love in this world.
Yeah, I mean, like,
and if you do, you're probably penalized for it.
Yeah, like the thing that, like, Ned and Kat have is rare, and it's kind of like a surprise.
It was forced upon them to begin with. It didn't happen immediately. It happened over years.
And,
so
and you see in the books Kat's POV, where she was, like, legitimately attracted to Ned's older brother, but then he got killed, and now she's marrying this grim face Stark who wasn't really into it, and she was had a lot of mixed feelings about it. And it contrasts that to Cersei, who was excited to marry the big, strong, handsome Robert Baratheon, who was lovesick over Lyanna Stark and never really did anything but kind of use her. And, like, it's just story after story of people being disillusioned or occasionally pleasantly surprised that, oh, wow, I actually can love this person. But
it seems like you also pay a price for that, right? Especially someone in Tyrion's position. Or, like, look at Rob. You know, it's causing him all sorts of problems in this war.
Right.
Because he chose to go with his heart instead of his head.
Yeah, like in a Machiavellian world, emotions are almost never good. Mm-hmm. Because they're just things that can be used against you and cloud your judgment of what is ultimately, empirically, the right thing to do.
Right. So then we go to Joffrey calling Tywin to the throne room to give him an update on the small council meetings and to ask why they haven't done anything about the threat of Dany's dragons. Tywin doesn't believe the dragons will ever be big enough to pose a threat. And then Joffrey is really upset that he's not being consulted on anything. So Tywin soothes his worries by promising that he will be consulted when necessary. This is a really good scene. Charles Dance, just fucking incredible.
His walk off where he's just he just kind of swaggering off the throne and kind of smirking at, like, and that scene,
I mean,
where
even
walk
up, like,
when he
climbs the stairs,
Joffrey was
to,
like,
demonstrate the point.
Yeah, like, I'm giving you a lot of fucking runway here, grandson, but now I'm going to step right up on your level, and if you keep giving me lip, guess what's going to happen? Like, I mean, it's funny because we've debated, like, Tywin and whether he'll be able to get this Boy King under heel, but, like, the early results looks like that Joff is terrified.
In fact,
it's kind of amazing, after seeing this scene, that he worked up the courage to give his grandpa a lip at all.
Yeah.
Like, essentially, why aren't I being consulted about these small council meetings? Why are you having them in your house instead of my house?
You are being consulted at this very moment.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Yeah, and like, well, we can always have you carried. And just everything about Charles Dance is amazing. Like, the slightest of bows that he gives to Joffrey as he says, "Your Grace," at the beginning. Like, it's barely imperceptible.
Yeah.
Or it's barely perceptible, I should say.
Mm-hmm. I do have one big question in this scene. Why is Joffrey taking the active role, or trying to take an active role now?
That's a great question, and I wonder if Margaery put him up to it, or if he's like emboldened by murdering Roz, and he thinks, oh, I'm a man now, and I'm like, oh, and like, since Grandpa's been here, I haven't known shit about what's going on. Like, maybe I don't know. It doesn't seem like it's something Margaery would put him up to. I don't think it's something that Cersei would put him up to. I think it's kind of came from within. Like, I'm a man full grown.
Yeah, it's just sort of weird for Game of Thrones to do that, I guess. Like, normally they give you a reason leading up to someone's decisions.
Yeah.
But here he just kind of makes it out of the blue.
Yeah, I think you're supposed to. I mean, I shouldn't say you're supposed to. I say that I say that because you just see scene after scene of Tywin scribbling notes and meeting with the small council, and the king's never there, and he's just taking all these unilateral actions without any kind of. And I think that has it's amazing how long, like, what is this, the seventh episode? It's taken this long, you know, because Tywin rode in at the end of last season. It's taken this long for Joffrey to notice, hey, I'm not even really. Am I even really the king?
I just feel like they could have, like, dropped the line to him about Dany, because we don't even know how he found out about Dany's dragons, right? Like, just have Varys mention something
or
and him looking concerned.
He's riding in a litter through town and he sees out his window as he's holding his nose like a mummer's thing about Dany and her dragons. Something. You're right.
Something. It was just out of the blue. It kind of put me off, but hopefully it has consequences going forward and they're setting something else up. So then, speaking of Dany, she comes upon the city of Yunkai, which might pose a threat to her goals if she tries to take it. Unfortunately, her conscience will not let her sit by as slaves in the city continue to be slaves, so she tells Grey Worm to deliver a message to Yunkai: surrender or suffer the same fate as Astapor. Then one of the masters comes out to meet her, and he offers to forgive her for her actions in Astapor and give her gold and ships as long as she takes them and leaves for Westeros. Dany counters by offering his life in exchange for the slave's freedom, and she kicks him out of her tent without his chest of gold. Then she tells Jorah, find out who the powerful friends that he mentioned are. Man, I usually like Dany. I think she's not very calculated in her decisions most of the time. She's inexperienced, she's young, she's a lot like Rob in that way. But this, I cannot picture a scenario in which Littlefinger, Varys, Tywin, Tyrion, anybody without power or with power would get into this without knowing who those powerful friends are.
You're not wrong. It really shows how that's like, you think of the small council. She's essentially got two guys dueling for the position of Lord Commander of the Queen's Guard.
Uh-huh, and maybe her bang piece.
Exactly. Like, she doesn't, and bed warmer. One of them is jockeying for bed warmer. The other's like, I'm too old for this shit. She doesn't have a master coin. She doesn't have, a master of whispers. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have a citadel-trained maester training her with the diplomacy and... She doesn't know anything. The one trick she's got is she's got dragons and a fierce army and some swagger and, you know, flush from previous victories, and she feels righteous. So she's going with that. And I felt like her show, I don't know, I guess I felt her show of strength was appropriate.
No, I like her sentiment. Like, I want to go free these slaves. That's my number
200,000.
One goal here.
I got 200,000 reasons to free the city.
And nothing is going to stop me, no matter how weak I seem in the moment. But I just think that she needs to calculate her moves a little bit better.
Right. I was also like, man, when they're offering her all this gold and as many ships as she needs to go to Westeros, like, wow, what an opportunity.
Yeah.
What an opportunity.
It's tempting. But I also think she doesn't have the army she needs, right? Like, she can get the ships, she can get the gold, maybe she can buy an army with the gold, I don't know. But right now, she doesn't have what she needs to conquer Westeros.
Yeah, it's... You would have to do a lot of diplomacy. You'd take the seed of, like, your 8,000... your 8,000 Unsullied and the Promise of Dragons and your famous name, and you would have to, you know, land at a place that's like, but that's the thing, she doesn't even have, she would have no idea, like, where would you land in Westeros right now that would be your best shot at a foothold?
Mm-hmm.
Like, your ancestral home, Dragonstone, Stannis is camping there with the remainder of his army. Good luck taking that. You know, like, where, like, in the north, there's no one there. You know, like, where is the place, like, she doesn't have any idea, so... It's weird because, like, the fanboy in me wants her to take her ships and her army and her dragons and go over there, but the fan of great drama sees that she's really untested and untried and needs a lot more experience.
She does. She does.
But she at least knows the answer. She at least knows to ask the right questions, like, who are these powerful friends? Let's find out. Mm-hmm. Because this was all foreplay. You know, him with the chest of gold, her with the dragon snapping. This, like, the, you know, these are just threats and saber rattlings until she figures out his full strength. And I don't know. It seems like it's an okay way to play for now.
All right, we go on to Tyrion trying to smooth things over with Shay. She is less than interested in letting his wedding to Sansa go. And he promises he'll buy her a home in the city and give her fine clothes as well as children. She says that she's just his whore, and when he gets tired of fucking her, she will be nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of an accurate statement from the start of your relationship, yes?
No, well, that's what I'm like. What I thought was interesting is everything here was a completely honest conversation. It's just a conversation about people that it's time for them to part ways because, like Tyrion said, like, cross a narrow sea and do what? Juggle, be a fool? Because that's what he could do. That's what he could do in the Free Cities.
Right. And you're worried about me banging Sansa? What are you going to do when we get over there, huh?
Right.
You're going to go back to your profession?
Right.
Am I going to be cool with that?
Yeah. Like, it's tough because, like, what he can provide her is a very comfortable living, and she could be the true woman behind the great man, as you know, however attractive that might be to her. And, like, you know, this vague concept of always be your lady, but that's not enough for Shay. So
I mean, that's the thing, that's what Tyrion promised her, right? That she could come to King's Landing and be the Hand's Lady,
right?
I don't know what she took that to mean, though. Like, there's obviously no official marriage in the cards here,
right?
She should have known that from the start. I think Tyrion said as much.
Mm-hmm.
I get why she's upset, but what is Tyrion to do?
What am I to do, Shay? There's not enough eyebrows in the world. These are frustrating things to watch because they're people trying to make a connection that just can't be made. And I think Tyrion is smarter. And I also do not see what he sees in Shay. And that's what, like, every time I go and read interviews with the Double D's and even George Martin himself saying, oh, when we got this Shay character and she just blew us away with how charming and attractive. And then I've met her. She's a perfectly nice lady, woman. And I don't mean this to disparage her in any way. But, like, to get this under Tyrion's skin, I think she would have to be just, like, jaw-droppingly beautiful and, like, and insanely charming.
Mm-hmm.
She'd have to be, like, I don't even know. I don't even know to make me believe that Tyrion would just be, at some point, just be like... But on the other hand, like, he's starved with love, and she professes to love him.
And I'm going to say this.
But the thing is, like, here's the thing.
Yeah.
If I want to talk brass tacks, I don't believe Tyrion in his, what, 30 years of life... And all the whoring that he has done, I don't think that Shay is really the first prostitute to try the, like, oh, I've got a Lannister in my bed. I'm going to really turn on the jets and, like, you know, try to ingratiate myself. Like, Tyrion should be an expert at shedding this kind of attention the way a duck has evolved to shed water off their feathers, man.
We know she's not.
Right.
I mean, he was married to her before, so.
Right. Although, yeah, that's... complex and maybe a spoiler, but
they say it in this episode.
But I think there's more to the story that we know so far. Anyway.
Okay.
I just don't buy that. I don't think the show did, like, because they played a game of truth and dare, like, when they're drunk. Like, that's the thing that, like, sold them on her. Because, like, I just have never seen why Tyrion would be anything but cynical about this relationship.
Yeah, and here's the thing about Shay. She's got an uphill battle when she's going to give what is basically everyone's favorite character shit.
Yeah.
Everyone loves Tyrion.
Yeah.
Everyone across the board loves Tyrion. So when you have a character directly opposed to that character he needs, you're going to hate that character.
You know, if they had a concrete scheme where, like, kind of like a Loras Renly thing where she's pushing him to some greatness that is dangerous but attainable.
If she made him better in some way.
If there's, like, some kind of, like, scheme they had, like, well, if we do this, that, and the other, then my dad's head will be in a noose and I will rule Westeros, or I've got a way to, like, get away the 100 million gold dragons and we can go and fucking buy a free city and I'll make dwarves the rulers of the land. I get it, but, like, it's just her always complaining about things that are impossible and him always feeling hurt and betrayed, and it seems like it's just a terrible relationship.
Yeah, it does.
And again, there's definite reasons that Tyrion could be susceptible, but like I said, you have to ignore the rest of the history that he's lived through to, you know, I don't know, maybe she's a one in a million something to Tyrion, but I've never bought it.
All right, Melisandre and Gendry sail to King's Landing as she tries to convince him that he's the son of the king. Seems like it works. He looks up at that castle and goes, oh, shit, yeah.
No, I mean, this is like, you feel like Gendry is starting the hero's journey. You know? Like, you're Luke Skywalker and you just found out that you are the son of the most powerful Jedi in the galaxy. And, like, everything about this scene is epic in its staging. Like, I love them silently gliding over the shipwrecks and how, like, fucking eerie that is, and it also allows Melisandre to get in her dig of, like, none of this would happen if I was here. And, you know, finding some stuff about Mel, the fact that she was a background as a slave, and now arguably she is one of, if not the most powerful woman in Westeros, in terms of her influence on the Stannis, the rightful king. And the behold your father's house sequence as that dawns on Gendry of, like, you know, what she's talking about here and his royal blood. I thought was really great and exciting.
Are they going to clean up these shipwrecks?
You'd have to dredge a channel or something.
Right.
Yeah. Like, in fact, I was expecting, like, I don't know that ship's keel is going to make it over that. That ship looked much, I thought is going to, like, you just hear his crunch and, like, but yeah, you'd think that they would need to dredge at least a channel so people can get in and out.
They should probably get on that.
I imagine Joffrey's not too quick to clean, like, you know, maybe they get a channel, but I think he likes seeing the bones of all those ships and being like, look at what I did.
Right.
You come at me crazy and look what happens.
It's like the dragon skulls,
it's Ned's head on the parapet writ large, you know?
All right, then we go to Arya, still pissed about the Brotherhood giving up Gendry. The archer comes in. I don't know his fucking name.
Augury.
Says they found a group of Lannister soldiers. Everyone decides to go after them instead of doing what Arya wants. And she makes a break for it. And she's grabbed in the woods by the Hound, who's been skulking about, lurking in the woods.
Hoping to catch an Arya?
Maybe hoping to catch a Brotherhood, a Bannerman? Like,
pay back a little bit.
Yeah, a no-Bannerman?
Yeah, settle a score. It is interesting why he is this close enough to, like, you know, like this, she what, made it 300-400 yards out of the cave?
Yeah, and we don't really know.
But it's interesting for Sandor because now he's got a hostage that, you know, like if you're thinking about him playing his version of the Game of Thrones, like maybe he's starting to think, hey, maybe I could get back. Like I just said, fuck the king. How do I undo that? Capturing Arya Stark is a good first step for any kind of man in his position.
Yeah,
because you could ingratiate yourself with the king in the north. you could probably be fairly well rewarded by returning her to Stannis, because that's a chip for him. You could definitely mm-hmm. maybe worm your way back into the king's favor by returning her to Winterfell, or not Winterfell, King's Landing, so that the match set. So it makes sense. It makes sense from his perspective what a boon that is.
Yeah. Then Jaime visits Brienne the night before he leaves. He promises to return the Stark girls to their mother, and they say goodbye. Then the next morning, Jaime packs his horse, and he rides off as Locke taunts him and says, they'll take good care of Brienne.
I really liked this scene of Jaime visiting Brienne in the dungeon as a nice coda to their bathtub sequence, because mm-hmm. that moment at the end where she says, goodbye, Sir Jaime, and Jaime's the look on his face, like the because it's not the first time he's been referred to as Sir, but it's almost always with a little bit of mocking behind it, or because people feel like they have to because he's the Lannister and he's a Kingsguard. Someone that clearly respects the code of chivalry and can't be a knight because of what she, you know, because she was born without a penis, if we're being mm-hmm. being accurate. But someone that like embodies all those qualities and has been nothing more than righteous with him, saying that and like humanizing him, it really touches him.
Yeah, and this scene shows that Brienne's mind about Jaime was changed when mm-hmm. when, you know, he told his story about how the Mad King's death really went down.
Mm-hmm. It's just not that. I think she... I mean, that's definitely the icing on the cake.
That's a huge part
of it.
That's what telling him, you know, you now have this responsibility, and him making
right.
this oath.
Right.
If she didn't trust him, if right. she didn't understand that oath breaker mm-hmm. Is just a name that people yeah. have called him, a slur against him,
yeah.
then that scene would be nothing.
But I also want to discount the things that he's actually done, putting himself on the line to spare Brienne, you know. So it's not just his words and his tragic backstory, but you're starting to see the hero inside Jaime shine through, and mm-hmm. Brienne sees that too, and that's why it's just a really meaningful exchange.
But the hero that's always been there.
Yes.
You know, he's not the coward and the betrayer, the treasonous betrayer that people say he is.
Yeah, Jaime grows up in the Stark household.
Mm-hmm.
Totally different story.
Yeah. Then there's that scene with Roos, which I kind of like, and Locke is just a shit.
Right.
But he'll...
Give.
Well, I was going to say he'll get his, but nothing happens to him at the end of this. Jaime just makes fun of him.
Yeah. And we find that Qyburn's going to come with him because he's hoping that, you know, saving Jaime's life is going to get him his chain back.
Uh-huh. All right, so Theon's taken off his cross. There's two pieces of wood that cross each other, so I'm going to call it a cross. I know it's not the typical configuration.
I think it's because I
don't know what the name for it
is.
My
writing partner Anthony used this, like, the learned term. I think it's like saltaire, maybe.
No,
like that,
me.
Like cross
okay.
that's on its side.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I know it's got a proper term. I just don't know quite
okay.
what it is. Or St. Andrew's cross is another one, because apparently that's how he was crucified.
So he's given some water and he's rubbed up and down by a couple of women who take their clothes off and begin grinding on him until a horn blows and the mop boy comes into the room in spectacular fashion. He has his men hold Theon down as the mop boy cuts off his cock.
Mm.
At least that's the implication.
Few alterations.
Take
off an inch here, an inch there. Yeah, this is torture.
I agree.
It's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
And not real feel-good nudity. Not the fun kind of nudity.
No, I don't have much to say about that scene other than ugh.
Yeah, I mean they're taking everything that Theon was proud of: his name, his house, his cock. Like this mop boy is just breaking him down. To what end? That's what I think people after watching 7 episodes of this are asking.
Yeah. All right. So then Ygritte and Jon go hunting, and they continue marching along the wall. On the road, they tease each other about being impressed by windmills and liking girls who swoon. And when Ygritte suggests that she'll take him to Winterfell once the free folk take their land back, Jon tells her history is not on her side and they can't win because their army is not a real army. Ygritte seems pretty fatalistic about the whole thing. If we die, we die, but first we'll live.
Right. I think these people are super cute, and they just got married recently. Kit Harington and Rose Leslie. Uh-huh. And like, I really enjoyed the scene where she's talking about she's wearing the finest silk from Tra La 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 Lolly Day or whatever. Uh-huh. And she falls back in her arms dramatically. It's cute. And like, him trying to explain the difference between a windmill and a tower and yeah. like the fact that women down south swoon. Mm-hmm. And she's like, the fuck? What swoon? What? Why? You know, and like, you know, the truism that like, you know, why would a woman be squeamish about blood? Because in their lifetimes, they probably see much more than your average man. And then like, just the desperation of him, like, you guys are going to get torn to pieces by a professional army. Mm-hmm. You guys are, you know, it's not about your courage, your bravery, your strength. It's about superior tactics and training and yeah. weaponry.
You're throwing rocks, they're swinging swords.
Right. Like, and it's about like supply chains and logistics. And like, mm-hmm. even if you do take Castle Black, they'll just get 50,000 mounted soldiers and you have zero. Mm-hmm. You know, you got maybe a giant or two riding the tank, which is not bad. But, you know, back in my Command and Conquer days, mammoth tanks didn't do too well against just masses of smaller units. So it's
true. Especially and he's like those bazooka guys.
Right. Yeah. And she just, yeah, I mean, this is a little bit of a Shay Tyrion situation in that it's like Ygritte can't see his point of view. Like, mm-hmm. how could she? She can't conceive. Yeah. of stacking stones high enough that that a farmer can just manage on his own.
Right.
And, you know, like she literally probably couldn't conceive of like a King's Landing, just like a caveman couldn't conceive of a helicopter.
Blow her freaking mind. Right. If she saw that.
Right. Whereas John has, you know, he's in a frustrating position. It's like, yeah, I've been north. I see all the good stuff about it, but it's not going to matter. But I don't know. It's like, the thing in the back of my mind is, like, Mance thinks this is possible. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's just complete desperation. Maybe he doesn't. And it's like, well, I'd rather die outside the wall than be ripped apart by whites and white walkers.
Yeah.
And yeah, maybe could be. Maybe I'm trusting that, like, I was... Like you know, it might be as simple as, like, hey, I show up outside the gates with 100,000 men, women, and children. Are the Black Brothers really going to butcher us down to the last person? Mm-hmm. And, like, if only the women and children survive... and they're safe, like, is that not a sacrifice worth making? Like, that some of us live, you know? Yeah. So, I guess, I don't know. I don't know whether Mance thinks he can win, or it's just a desperate gamble. And kind of, like, weirdly banking on the honor and humanity of the Night's Watch.
Yeah, I think the other important thing in this scene is that Ygritte is still trying to break John. You know, John, when he says... hey, you can't defeat them. Yeah. You will all die. He's not including himself in that group.
Right, and she calls him out on it.
Yeah, and she sees that. And I think she thinks that her love, his feelings for her will prevail here, which is, I guess, possible. But this has happened multiple times now, mm-hmm. and he is still, it seems, unbroken.
Right.
Well, because in you know, the way you break a horse kind of thing.
I think she just thinks that at the end of the day, she's correctly assessed the situation and I'm your lady and you're my man. And regardless of your feelings on macro politics, that's just going to carry the day. And I
mean,
and I don't think she cares about dying. Like, I think they just have a fundamentally different way of looking at life and death. And it's like, mm-hmm. okay, well, I'd rather do this than die on my knees. So. Yeah. That's the whole we'll live first, you know?
Okay, so we go to Asha, who gets upset.
How much in Kit and Rose's daily life do they quote Game of Thrones at each other?
I think they don't talk to each other except in Game of Thrones.
It's just like, yeah. It's always Ygritte, and that's what's in their cell phones. Like, I mean, there's no way it's zero. Like, it's
of course,
like every week they gotta have.
I mean, you know nothing. You know nothing,
yeah.
Jon Snow. I mean,
oh,
she has
God.
To say that to him daily.
Yeah, I would be profoundly disappointed and think that they have no sense of humor if this wasn't like a part of their semi-daily life.
Yeah,
because it's just, I don't think it would get old. How fucking cool would that be?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right?
Because it's got to be a cool experience filming this thing, and these characters are so iconic, and it's like it's just a fucking romantic as hell story, and mm-hmm. then it's happening in real life, like ah. I don't know. To me, that was more important than any royal wedding.
Yeah. I couldn't care less about
the king
royal
in the north marrying a princess, a wildling princess. Like, fuck the Windsors and
that's
their castles. Yeah. Give me Kit and Rose in a windmill any day.
So Asha gets upset that Jojen's just sitting around filling Bran's head with black magic, as she calls it. And she demands that they head to Castle Black. But Jojen and Bran are adamant about heading north to find the Raven beyond the wall. And Asha tells the story of Bruni, her man, who died and turned into a zombie and tried to kill her, which is why she refuses to go any further north than Castle Black.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good Hodor in this scene. I really appreciated the just how much and how little that says.
Yeah.
At the same time.
You said it all, Hodor.
Hodor.
You said it all. You said it all. Right on, man. As I was watching this, I'm like, this is kind of ridiculous because we're all aware of the White Walkers and how they operate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're essentially watching the Reed children and Bran get up to speed with where we've been since season one.
Sure.
But I think it was important to kind of like throw a wet blanket over Bran and Jojen's like wild optimism of like, oh, we're just like, you know, speaking in our little fucking twin language and you guys can't possibly understand. She's like, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Let me tell you what's about the true North, boys. So I don't know. Like I said, it was a little bit recappy for me, but I think it was an important character to make.
Yeah, it's something that needed to happen. And I guess this is, you know, what happens when you don't. When you have so many characters in so many different places, yeah. And none of them have all of the knowledge or the same knowledge,
yeah.
You have to kind of go over this multiple times. But I think it's also a pretty good refresher for, you know, the audience who may have forgotten about the stuff that we saw early on in the series.
Sure, sure.
So we go to Jaime then, who gets his bandage changed by Qyburn as he explains why he was demaestered. Apparently he was performing sick experiments on dying men. And Jaime is appalled by the thought until Qyburn points out that he's killed many men to save many more, just as Qyburn says he was doing.
Yeah, it's so funny because like Qyburn thought that was going to be a slam dunk moment. Like, oh, you've killed countless people, but how many have you saved, sir, Jaime,
yeah.
MD?
And he's like, 500,000.
Yeah, 500, yeah, half a million. What's your count, Qyburn? Yeah, go fuck yourself. That's what I thought.
Jaime asks if he'd heard from Brienne's father about buying Brienne's safe return. He has, but Qyburn doesn't think that Roose is going to take it because he's holding out for a boatload of sapphires, thanks to the idea that Jaime put in his head about Tart's vast mines. Then Jaime demands that they return to Harrenhal, and he badgers his captor into taking him there.
Yeah, that's... it's funny because, like, all of Jaime's heroics and theatrics and saving Brienne have now doomed her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he saved her honor, but now is going to lose her life because, you know, this Locke guy is like, 300 gold dragons, you got all every sapphire in the kingdom, you fucker.
Uh-huh.
I'm not giving your daughter up for that. So I love how Nikolai plays that, just with, like, the, like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is happening to me.
Mm-hmm. Also, I thought it was funny when he says, what's the purpose of an arm with no hand?
Mm-hmm.
You're the one who wanted to keep it, fucker.
Right.
You made Qyburn not chop it off, so
right.
don't question your handless arm.
Yeah, that's would be funny if Qyburn's like, he's like, I totally agree. Gets his knife out, the gleam in his eye.
Right.
I want to take it off the shoulder. Still not too late. So not too late.
Yeah.
And then he just like, Jaime is a bit frustrating here, but it's realistic, but like he... Like, you got this asshole who knows he's his worth as a hostage, mm-hmm. and he's going to play it to the hilt. And, yeah, I guess it also further ennobles his character because he's seen how... Jaime's putting his life on the line. Because, number one, like, these men could just decide, you know what? Fuck Lord Bolton. Mm-hmm. I don't care. Life here is nasty, brutish, or short anyway. YOLO, cut off his head. Or they could take his other hand. Or they could take his cock. Or... they could blind him, or like there's lots of ways that they can fulfill the letter of Roose Bolton's law without giving Jaime what he wants, and he's got to know that. His experience with Locke is demonstrating that. Yet he still puts his life and livelihood on the line to rescue Brienne.
Yeah, and he does so. He doubles down on that in this next scene where he arrives back in Harrenhal, finds Brienne in a pit with a bear. And so he jumps in to save her, and he barely makes that alive with the bear nipping at his heels. He tells Locke that he's taking Brienne with him to King's Landing and that Locke will have to kill him to stop it. Locke backs down.
Yeah. I mean
this, that you couldn't put your life and livelihood more on the line than jumping in a pit with a bear.
Yeah, yeah. Because the bear doesn't know that this is all a game staged for people's amusement.
And he looks a little bit like a maiden fair. So,
yeah.
You know, he's a little dirty,
yeah.
But he's got that nice flowing hair.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the bear mistakes him for, you know, a tasty maiden.
Sure. What kind of honey does he got? I do think that I do like how they've really played up the bear in a maiden fair. So you're aware of the concept and it's a nice little world building touch that like you can just see like how happy these Bolton guys would be to see this kind of like savage entertainment. And I don't know, it's kind of fucked up if you think about it, but it also was clever foreshadowing all the bear in a maiden fair stuff that we've seen before.
I mean,
and damn, Brienne, like, how long has she been in that pit? Like, she's been mauled already once, and she's got a wooden sword, and she's kept this bear at bay. Pretty badass, Brienne.
Yeah. She takes a couple of shots from the bear that we see as well.
And the one Bolton guy was, like, helping out with the crossbowing of the bear. Maybe that weakened him a little bit, gave him, because, like, it was a near thing. Like, Jamie almost got, like, a half second later, and that bear would have got clamped down on his ankle, and there'd be... There'd be one less Lannister running around the world.
Or one less foot on Jaime.
Yeah, one less foot on Jaime for sure.
Maybe.
But yeah, and I also like how the scene starts the bear in a maiden fair, and then it eventually turns into the reigns of the Castamere.
Yeah.
Lannister's triumphant, kind of. And then the parting shot of Sorry About the Sapphires.
Pretty good.
He's not sorry. I don't think he's sorry.
No, he's not. That's the end of the episode.
That is the end of the episode. Hey, I want to tell you about the club, the Bald Move Club, club.baldmove.com. It is how we pay for us to do full-time podcasting. Like, if you listen to our housekeeping segment, you realize that we produce a lot of content. There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes all the time, and the way we're able to finance that is almost entirely due to direct listener support. And it's not just charity. You get a lot of cool features for your money. You get ad-free feeds. You get special bonus audio and video features. You get to live watch us making the podcasts in real time, if that's something you're interested in. There's just a ton of stuff. And you can actually test drive most of these features. If you go to club.baldmove.com, we've selected ones that we think are interesting, and you can check them out. And also, you can get a free 30-day trial just by signing up to club.baldmove.com, and we'd appreciate your support.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car?
Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Let's talk some feedback, Jim.
Okay.
I've only got one fragment that I was able to recover from Sam. I don't know. Why am I trying to make this a first of the fist of the first man cash kind of thing? I got a one single email that's non-spoilery, and then we'll have a whole bunch of spoilery emails. It's from Lauren M. She goes, even though we don't know much about the Whites, when Asha's retelling the story about her run-in with the White that used to be her man, it sounds like he knew to go back to where they used to live. Has Gurm ever spoken about if Whites still have memories of their old lives? Not to my knowledge, although the So Spake Martin archive is wide and broad, and I certainly haven't read all of it. But I would also like to point out that in the first season, when we have the Black Brothers who were carried underneath the wall and reanimated, they knew to go right to the Lord Commander's quarters. Mm-hmm. Like they weren't fumbling around and like doing zombie shit from Walking Dead. They were almost like on a mission. So there's a couple ways you can interpret that. Maybe they retain some part of their memory, or whatever force is animating them and controlling them has access to the same memories. So whichever one it is, I do think there is something about when they take over a dead person, the White Walkers have the memories and intellect that person possessed, which is scary because it's a great way to get intelligence, right?
Yeah.
And that's not like set in stone. That's just what I think is what's happening when we look at these different situations. And we don't have a ton of information to go off of either. That is all the unspoiled email that we can consider at this time. We will have a spoiler section here in a minute. I just want to let everybody know that Game of Thrones at baldmove.com is where you want to send us these missives if you want to be considered for the podcast, and also forums.baldmove.com if you want to talk about the episodes with your fellow fans. And now we should get to the spoiler section. Jim, did you have any spoiler observation? First of all, Theon's torture count is now stands
six?
At six.
Okay.
Lots of torture.
Yeah.
Cut off his cock.
Yep. And then there's a really just awesome Ramsay eating sausage scene here, coming up.
It's a real treat. It's a real gif-able, memeable moment.
Very good.
Did you have anything you want to talk about? I had a couple points.
Yeah, just one small one. The scene where Jaime's leaving and he's talking to Roose and he says the Lannisters send their regards. That's obviously coming back in episode 9.
Yeah.
When he slits Rob's throat.
I think he stabs him.
Stabs Rob?
And
yeah.
And says, Jaime Lannister sends his regards, or the Lannisters send their regards.
Yeah.
Also, same scene, Locke taunts Jaime by saying, go buy yourself a golden hand.
Mm-hmm.
He does. Totally does. And it's actually a somewhat fearsome weapon of war. I want to talk about a contemporary theory that was really popular in these Twilight moments of season 3, which is Talisa as a Lannister spy.
Okay.
And if you recall that, like, she's writing this missive in a foreign language, and, like, Rob pointedly asks, like, oh, what are you writing? Who are you writing? Oh, my mother. Oh, is that a language that I can't understand? And there's a lot of prominent sequences in the previous chat season where she is similarly, like, they make it a big point that she's embedded in Rob's camp, and she's always, like, scribbling on scrolls and writing things. And there was a really big theory that had some kind of robust theory crafting behind it, that it turns out that she was going to be a Lannister spy that was keeping Tywin apprised of all of Rob's strength and movements and where he's going to be. I don't think that's true. And in fact, it's like I would say it's an undisprovable argument, because maybe she was the spy, and, you know, Tywin just, you know, eliminated her to eliminate witnesses or whatever to his villainy. I don't know. But
if I were going to try and throw some doubt on it, I would say Tywin loses a lot of battles against Rob. And if he had perfect knowledge of his whereabouts and numbers and positioning, he probably wouldn't lose those battles.
But I think that's one of the pieces of evidence, is that Rob was winning all of his battles until Talisa showed up on a battlefield. Once she joined his camp, he started facing, you know, like, setbacks, and also Tywin kept kind of running from him, and, you know, he's somehow the mountain's eluding him. But, you know, I think that's more to do with Edmure's stupidity. But it was a contemporary theory that I thought, because I didn't give it much credence because, you know, I knew what was coming. But it was a very popular theory, and I just want to throw it out there because that's kind of one of the things we do. Try to, like, and it's weird because, like, this whole season, I was thinking, like, where's a good point to talk about this? Because it would be fun to advance theories. Like if I had a perfect recall of, like, where the fandom was at this point in the season, like, to, like, let the people who are not spoiled but it's weird because if a theory is accurate, it would be a spoiler. So if I'm just divulging, hey, here's what's in the zeitgeist, it's Talisa as a spy, people would be assuming, well, that's not a right theory, or why would Aaron be talking about it? So I just do it for fun here, and the spoiler theory for everybody to remember, oh yeah, that was a thing. Anything else?
Nah.
All right. Alexis M. from Los Angeles says, Miri Mazdura kept saying that only death can pay for life. It occurred to me now how often this theme pops up in the Song of Ice and Fire series. When Dany builds the funeral pyre for Drogo, three people go into the fire and three dragons come out. I know there's a theory out there about Dany being a reanimated fire white. Maybe this is some evidence for that. Khal Drogo is already dead, yes, but she was letting go of his life with that ceremony. Did Drogo, Miri Mazdur, and Dany herself pay for the life of the dragons with their own? If true, perhaps that fact is Dany is some sort of undead creature, as is Jon Snow, meaning their deaths could pay for a life, specifically one that will grow in Dany's undead womb. Life from death, right?
I mean, I think the show... I don't know how the books handle this, but the show, in my mind, has said Dany was unfazed by that fire.
Right.
Not that she was burned up and killed and came back. They say that, essentially, she's immune to heat and fire and stuff like that. Maybe only in certain moments.
Right.
But, I mean, that bathtub scene where we first see her, the water's so fucking hot, it burns people.
Yeah.
No, she's sitting in it like it's nothing.
It's indisputable that in the show, Dany has fireproof powers because it's demonstrated, or heatproof powers, I guess. It's demonstrated many, many times.
Yeah.
In the books, it's not a thing. Like, George Martin says it's not a thing. Dany gets burned by her dragon's fire. I think she gets burned when she's trying to pull a spear out of Drogo's flesh, and just the heat of the spear sears her hands. And she later has bandages, and she's complaining about, oh, my hands are hurt because they're burnt. But yeah, it's definitely a show thing. I do like the symmetry of her actually dying, but in some kind of weird dark blood magic, her life force was channeled into the dragons, and that somehow brought her back as well. And there's also a fourth life, if you want to throw in there, that the, you know, Rhaego, the son that she lost, miscarried during this whole fiasco too. And it is, but that's the thing, like, now you're starting to see the problems of the theory, right? Well, Drogo was dead already, so, like, Miri burned alive, Danny burned alive, and a corpse burned alive, and that was life for life. Like, Danny smothering him with a pillow earlier in the day counted for that. And then, like, what about the Rhaegal thing? Did that save Drogo's life? But the more I think about it, the less convenient it is. And also, like, I honestly don't know what Martin's playing with. Would he do something kind of that ghoulish where, like, if John and Danny are, like, undead people giving birth to a live baby, like, is that going to – what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Because if it's just, well, they died and now they're alive and they're indistinguishable from any other living person, then all this talk of fire and ice zombies seems overblown. Because we've seen a white. We know what a white looks like. And does not look like Jon Snow. Like, we've seen fucking Uncle Benjen come back. We know what an animate, friendly, has all their wits about them white looks like. And it's not that. So, and if anything, Jon being brought back by Melisandre and not, like, through some kind of old god's magic, they'd both be fire zombies. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of problems with the theory.
And also, it doesn't seem like that religion requires a life for a life.
Right.
Because the people who bring them back don't lose their lives.
True, but they lose parts of their soul, is what's the report. You're making the stink face.
Does Thoros lose part of his soul, or does Beric, when he comes back?
That's what he says. That's what he professes. But both in the books and the series, it's something that he states and he feels, but there's not, like, a lot of freaking evidence. And I think there's even one scene where John says he doesn't feel like quite himself, but, like, he still acts identically to any other season of Jon Snow. So, you know, and the thing is, like, what will happen in the books? Because John's dead, like, as we speak. He still lies dead after being betrayed by his fellow brothers at the end of Dance of Dragons. So who knows what Martin is going to do? But the show has gone their own way, and I don't think any of that stuff is going to play out. Tiang from Worcester, Massachusetts. I was watching Sansa and Margaery's scene, and I wanted to address what I feel is a somewhat unjustified Sansa hate train. Sansa's entire storyline, both in the books and the show, operates as a reflection of Gurm's criticism of conventional Western high fantasy and fairy tales. The pretty princess who dreams of one day marrying a prince charming, becoming queen, and birthing kings is summarily punished for her naivete, becomes trapped in a nightmarish lion's den, and as the plaything of a psychotic incest-bred prince and is stripped of all of her agency. So she is never meant to be an Arya, Dany, or even a Margaery. In this world of political machinations, backstabbing, blood magic, and so on, I think what Gurm wanted to do with Sansa was portray a regular-ass girl who really just doesn't have it all together, and with a little more than a famous name and her wits, does her best to keep her head above water while she swims with sharks. And it works. In the first 5 seasons, Sansa Stark proves herself as queen of being able to survive just about anywhere, no matter the circumstances. And she does live. When many others that were faster, stronger, smarter, and more cunning have died, sweet dear Sansa Stark has lived. Now, in order to step into the greatness of her Starkdom, Sansa has to outgrow that naivety. By the end of Season 5 and the beginning of Season 6, she has. She's the one that convinced the battle-weary Jon that they had to fight for Winterfell. The Knights of the Vale rode for her. In Season 7, she ran a hell of a tight ship as essentially Queen Regent of the North, securing the North's food supplies for winter and getting Winterfell battle-ready. Let's give Sansa the credit she deserves.
I think we do now.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. We didn't like Sansa early on. I think pretty much everybody's mind has been changed at this point.
I mean, pretty much. But, like, just as we saw in Breaking Bad, almost everybody disliked Skyler in the beginning, and most everybody came around to be like, that's fucked up, and she didn't deserve any of this. Mm-hmm. But there's always holdouts, right?
Yeah, you know? That's why I say pretty much. Not,
yeah, yeah.
Not de facto everybody.
But no, I feel like this is, we are watching, like, Sansa's nadir here. And the last time that she kind of like gets her agency taken away is when she gets shuffled off to the Vale. But from there on, she starts reclaiming and figuring out how the thing, you know, partially because of Littlefinger's tutelage, she starts figuring things out and making her own moves. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, by the end of Season 7, she just flips the tables on Littlefinger. So,
and I'll throw out, look, you can use the excuse that we've used for Rob in this episode. He's very young. So is Sansa. Sansa's even younger than he's supposed to be.
And
so.
and while Rob was trained to be a warrior and a leader, Sansa was not trained for any of this shit. She was trained in needle pointing, looking pretty, good posture, and polite conversation.
Like,
yes. Nothing prepared her for being thrown into, as you say, the lion's den of King's Landing.
Right.
So, like, she's younger than Rob, less experience, and has zero preparation. At least Rob, you know, was taught to be a warrior and a leader.
Yeah.
Sean McGee, in your discussion of the climb, you talked about how cool it was to see Tywin Lannister match up with the Lyanna Tyrell in the Battle of Wits. Tywin's trump card was naming Loras to the Kingsguard. I don't remember exactly what happens in the books, but in the books, Loras has at least one other brother, although I think there's something wrong with him. So I can't imagine this would have worked. Was Cersei engaged to Loras a thing in the books? And if so, how did Olenna come to agree to it? I mean, it's this part is super simplified and stripped down in the show as compared to the books. And there is no analogous scene because neither Tywin nor Olenna are POV characters. So you'd never just see them in a room scheming alone. You're right. Loras's older brother, Willis, I think is his name, had some sort of crippling disease, like a club foot or a lame foot that kept him from like being the warrior that Loras was. But he is the heir to Highgarden, which is not nothing. And in the books, similarly, Tywin kind of breaks Cersei and says that, no, I'm going to remarry you. But he listed off a whole bunch of possibilities, like marrying Balon Greyjoy to bring the Iron Islands back into the fold. And his wife, I think, was of falling health. Marrying her to Oberyn Martell to kind of smooth over that old wound that we're about to find out is a wound. Mm-hmm. There's some red wines, Theon Greyjoy, one of the Martell princes, and Willis Tyrell. But nothing ever came of it because then, you know, the Joffrey is poisoned, and that led to the trial, which led to Tyrion eventually killing him. So, and then. Then Cersei was free to do whatever the fuck she wanted for two books, and it was terrible. And she essentially tried to lead on every man and manipulate them with her bed and promises of marriage. And it's pretty. Because the funny thing about that in the books is that she's not aware that everyone that she thinks she's seducing is using her. Like, they're actually spies for other people, or you're manipulating her because she just, you know, she doesn't have the experience to do this shit either. Alex G., I'm very much enjoying your Game of Thrones retrospectives. Well, thank you. Just wanted to weigh in with the defense of Rob as we approach the Red Wedding. I think your take on him was a bit harsh. Compared to his arc with Daenerys, they both have had potential. They both are kids. They both make many early mistakes. The difference is that every one of Rob's mistakes blow up in his face, whereas Daenerys ends up with minor roadblocks that generally turn into learning experiences. Examples. Both are betrayed by someone they shouldn't have trusted, Theon and Jorah. Theon's betrayal fractures Rob's kingdom, but Jorah's betrayal fizzles when his assassination attempt fails. Rob's biggest mistake, marrying someone he shouldn't have in a way that sets him back politically. Daenerys does the same thing in Meereen, but her husband gets murdered by the Sons of the Harpy before there are any real consequences to her decision. Rob needs more troops and is forced to go to the frays, while Dany needs more troops and is captured by the Dothraki. Rob gets murdered while Daenerys gets a brand new army. I could go on. And I, you know what, Alex, you are right. The writer is on Daenerys' side and he is not on Rob's side.
Yeah, I mean, well, I would say that is what you get when you put your fate in the hands of fate. Like, when you don't take your own future by the reins.
Right.
Because I don't see Tywin being in any of those situations, right? I don't see someone more experienced and more careful being in those situations. And I think the difference, I don't know. I view, like you said, look, Rob has been trained. Rob has been counseled many times on being a warrior, being a leader. That's who he needs to be because he's the eldest of the Stark family, right? Mm-hmm. He's one day going to take over Ned's position. Mm-hmm. So he should know better. Mm-hmm. Dany shouldn't know better. Dany needs a lot of learning. She needs a lot of time to figure things out, whereas Rob shouldn't need nearly as much of that.
Yeah. And even Tywin, in his youth, when his father died and he took over, like, he inherited a realm in disarray. His father was generally a weak leader who got Twitter-pated by a young wife and wasn't paying attention to his duties at court and to his own bannermen, and he'd let these reigns of Castamere become almost as wealthy and powerful as the Lannisters. So when Tywin went to bring them the heel, I mean, I don't. That was a toss of the die because this was a large, powerful house, and if he had the majority of the lords on his side and raised the banners and crushed Tywin, or instead of, you know, essentially instead of insulting Tywin, if Tywin showed up, he just, you know, took him prisoner and took over the thing. Like, what we would not have the image of Tywin as this great master tactician. So he had a little bit of luck on his side, I think. is a one way to read that scenario, and Danny did too, and Rob did not, because I do agree with the analysis here that essentially every one of Rob's mistakes was punished harshly, where Danny has just the thickest of plot armor.
she got soft landings on all that stuff.
And
here's the weird thing is, I think retrospectively I give Danny a little more leeway because she does have this arc where she learns a lot, and she, you know, makes a few mistakes, and sometimes they threaten to blow up in her face. Sometimes they do in a minor way, but but she is on this path of learning, whereas Rob gets, you know, cut down in his prime. And I give her a little more latitude because I know the journey she's going to take. And I think people were a lot less patient with Danny in the first watch because they didn't know where it was going. They didn't know if it would ever go anywhere, that kind of stuff.
No, I mean, that's the thing. Like, once you settle down and accept the fact that she's just not going to sail to Westeros and kick ass, dude. Like, I remember being very frustrated with that whole arc when I was reading it. But then I read, was it the Myrinese Blot, I think? It was a blog, like a big WordPress blog, and this guy laid out this argument that, like, you know, this is actually really intense political, you know, potboiler thriller kind of stuff. And when I read it a second time, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm seeing these were necessary. Like, you know, it's not as exciting because, like, everything in the first three books just fucking is relentless. You know, Ned gets killed, banners get raised, kings start marching, battle,
betrayals, and
Danny's just cool in her heels over there and slowly amassing power. But that's like, that's definitely an interesting thing. It's just not, it's Martin subverts his own expectations by having the first three books be these like tightly plotted thrillers, and the others then become kind of meandering and whatnot. But but yeah, if you can on second watches and you really appreciate what they're doing with Danny, it's entertaining. It's just not what I think people were wanting or expecting from the jump. Lauren has a couple of mini questions for us. Marjorie mentions the Sands that her son could be Lord of Casterly Rock in the North. Do you think Tywin would have ever given Tyrion's son Casterly Rock? I mean, you're talking about something, if Tyrion knocks up Sansa right now, that this kid is not even going to be thinking about Lord of anything until he's like 16 or so, 15 or 16. How long will Tywin live? Because once Tywin's dead,
it's fair.
Jaime, you know, the thing is like at this point in the story, Jaime is like best buds with Tyrion. Like, they are really good friends and they love each other. And you know, Jaime loves Cersei, and he's a Kingsguard. And what are the odds that Tywin dies and suddenly, like, if anyone is going to make a claim? Like Tywin died and just Jaime keeps his mouth shut, Tyrion's Lord of Castle Rock. Like, that's just, I mean, I don't know what kind of wills and testaments you can live, but, like, I don't think there's any kind of document that would screw. Unless Tywin, before he died, strong-armed Joffrey into signing some kind of, like, stripping Tyrion of his lands and titles and inheritance.
That's who I'm worried about. I don't know exactly that I'm worried about, like Tywin saying, oh, you got to do this to Tyrion. But Joffrey seems like the wild card there because he hates his uncle.
Not only that, I could see it's like a Baratheon situation where Joff sits on the throne, but he gives his younger brother, like, Castle Rock in the same way that, like, you know, Stannis got Dragonstone and Renly got Storm's End. So, like, all three brothers reigned a big, big prestigious castle. So I could see Joffrey doing that. Like, Tommen goes and takes Castle Rock, and Tyrion's kids don't get shit. But
yeah, I could see
it's
Joffrey.
An interesting what if.
Joffrey might give him the windmill.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Yeah. And
the
it's
Lord
have
of the Wind.
Off of it. Because that's a good, that, you know, if Joffrey continued being a mad king little shit, and Tyrion's the only thing that ever kept him, and, like, as soon as Tyrion, or I'm sorry, as soon as Tywin died, like, it might be a real fucking dark age in Westeros.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
unless
Tyrion,
Margaery can,
Tyrion might just get killed because, like, Joffrey fucking hates him.
Yep.
He hates him for being right. He hates him for all the slaps of his stupid face. He hates him for trying to rein him in when he was king.
He hates him for surviving his first murder attempt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Lauren, she continues, I've definitely read a lot of fan theories that say if Sansa were to be with anyone after war is over, it should be Tyrion. He's the only person who's ever never tried to hurt her or use her for her station. Do either of you like this theory?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what legs it has, but I do think that's an accurate assessment of Tyrion as a person.
Yes.
I don't think he would hurt Sansa.
I'm ambivalent because I kind of feel like Sansa deserves to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that Tyrion is, even after everything she's been through and her appreciation, I don't know that that's her ideal match.
Yeah, that's probably fair.
And there's just so much history there. Like, sometimes, like, maybe in an alternate universe that would have been, but, like, I just don't know that she could, like, is that something you just joke about, like, when you're an old married couple? Like, oh, remember when you were traded to me like a fucking horse and I was, and how you were scared to look at my car? Like, I don't know. I don't know. This doesn't seem romantic to me. And, yeah, like, I think that would be an interesting resubversion if at the end Sansa gets some sort of romantic kind of ending that befits her dreams, since she's went through so many nightmares. I'm not saying that that's something Martin might do. I'm just saying that, like, I'm not the biggest Tyrion Sansa shipper. If Gendry survives the end, what do you think of the theory that he will be legitimized by either Jon or Dany? I think it's fucking dangerous politically.
Yeah. No,
to legitimize the son of the old king, the usurper.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to really trust Gendry is never going to fuck you. Uh-huh. Because look up the War of the Dragons and approximate cause of that. And, you know, look at Maegor the Cruel, was it Maegor the Cruel, or was it, it was Aegon the Unworthy that legitimized all of his bastards on his deathbed, and it just led to a massive civil war, the Blackfyre Rebellion. Like,
yeah.
Historically, nothing much good happens when you legitimize these bastards. What you would do is you find, like, Gendry and maybe make him a master of arms. You keep him close on your inner. You make him best buds. He's your hunting buddy. You make sure he gets a nice, suitable match. But I don't know.
I think it would throw a lot of cold water on some of the theories of how this will end.
Mm-hmm.
If they were to try and legitimize some new king.
Right.
For the Iron Throne.
Or just legitimize him, and he's not going to sit on the Iron Throne, so he's just...
Okay.
Because he wouldn't, like, if he's legitimized, and they go back to the original bloodline, mm-hmm. then he's nowhere near, like, ready to take on the throne. But this is not a statement against Gendry. You take a young man, and you legitimize him, and then you give him decades of noble lords that want to start shit whispering in his ear, you know, your father was the... And, you know, some people say that he was a lot better than these fucking Targaryens, and... It's just asking for trouble.
I thought you meant he wasn't even in line for it.
He's not.
Well, if he were legitimized, he wouldn't be?
I mean, he'd be so far behind so many other people. Because, like Bobby B's claim to the throne is he was, like, one of his great aunts was second cousins to a Targaryen.
Okay, well, yeah. I guess I was, like, looking at it from a starting over at Bobby kind of thing. You know,
yeah.
Like, let's forget about that whole Joffrey and Tommen experience.
Yeah. But then, Dany's not gonna. She's not gonna put him on the throne. So now I'm just saying that, like, it seems like it's rebellion bait to me.
Yeah.
Unless, again, the other thing is, like, I think there's going to be some sort of very proto Magna Carta type Athenian democracy that's the end of this. I think there's a lot of hints in season 7 towards that, and in that case, then you legitimize him, and then if he gets duly appointed by the Lords Paramount to sit on the throne, then whatever, you know. David B. I've been progressing through your rewatch podcast and Game of Thrones, and you refer to the wall as being depicted on screen as much shorter than the book description of 700 feet. I believe you even have references regarding the design team discussing this with Martin. However, I think you may be mistaken. If you take, and he sent copious photoshopped images to support his argument. You'll have to take my word for it here. Mm-hmm. If you take the picture of the wall of Castle Black at the base and the elevator clearly visible, shown below, you can extrapolate the height of the wall if you know the height of the highest towers of Castle Black. You can estimate the height of the towers of Castle Black from the scene showing the inner courtyard, second picture included below. Assuming the average height of a man in Westeros is around 5'6", it appears that each floor in the castle would be around 10 foot high. The rooftops in the higher towers would be around 45 feet high due to their steeple formation. Now you take that and match it against the elevator in the wall from the first picture, and you have an approximate height of the wall on the show in picture 3 below. There are 14 to 15 of these segments, giving the wall height of in the show around 630 to 675 feet. Although this is tall, it is basically a 70-story building, which is not all that shocking if you spent any time in New York City.
All right, let me say, no offense to the emailer. No offense to you, Aaron.
Yeah.
Because I know you loved, at one point, to engage in this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. This is the least interesting thing I've ever heard. I don't care to think about this for even 1 second.
All right. I mean,
but I know there are people out there who do.
Right.
I know there are.
And to
no offense to you.
And as someone who is, I will say, David, I don't have any problem with their math. And I actually went to try to find, because I was just going on my memory. This is something I didn't look up. So I actually went and saw if I could reconstruct how I arrived at this idea. And I found an interview with Martin where he showed up to the set where they filmed the wall, and it's in a stone quarry. And the walls of the stone quarry are around 300 some feet. And Martin remarked to the set guys, like, wow, like this is pretty much how it would look, huh? And the guy's like, oh no, these walls are like half the size of what the wall should be. And Martin said, he quote unquote said, oops. And I saw another interview where he claimed that he realized he fucked up the scale of the walls when he went to the Cliffs of Moher, or I don't know how to pronounce it, it's an Irish word. And those are exactly 700 foot tall, and he saw just how ridiculously high they'd be. Like, here's big problem with 700 foot walls and medieval technology. There ain't an archer in the world that can threaten a position that tall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like every time, like if you got the strongest man and the most powerful longbow, you would be hard pressed to shoot an arrow 400 feet into the air. So, like, there's absolutely shit all that the wildlings could do to ever threaten these positions unless they physically climbed the wall and took them hand to hand. And right. Good luck with, you know, we'll see how that goes in a couple of episodes or seasons. But so, I mean, I think you're right that the it's not quite 700 foot tall, even with your estimates, but it's closer than I thought. I thought I read somewhere that the CGI was scaled on like a 450 foot wall, but I could not find that anywhere. So anyway, like you said, Jim's bored as hell, and I was interested. So there you go. Rich from New York. Hey, guys, last episode had Ramsay offended that Theon would think he was an Umber. I think this is a nod to the books, given that the Umbers were traditionally rough and rugged men who lived in harsher conditions than the rest of the North, given their proximity to the Wall. Their house sigil is also of a giant in chains, so I suspect that there are rumors or made-up stories about them, which would certainly inform Ramsay's opinion. Anyway, as was shown in Season 6, Small John Umber betrayed the Starks by giving up Rickon Stark and then fought with the Boltons on their side during the Battle of the Bastards. This obviously is in contrast to what happens in the books, where the Umbers are fiercely loyal to the Starks, even having Small John as Robb's personal guard. I know you talked about this during your Season 6 recaps, but I was wondering if you had any new thoughts on the change in story since you've all been rewatching the series from the beginning. The great John Umber is still shown to be a great supporter of Robb as the King of the North, and the Umbers in general are still shown to be loyal to the Starks since they provide shelter in Rickon. I mean, the unsatisfying answer is Season 6 is where the Double D's is just like, fuck you, George, we're doing whatever we want. And yeah. We need to, I can't state this over much. The Battle of the Bastards hasn't happened yet. It's being set up at the end of Dance with Dragons. So they have zero information to go on. They got maybe we don't know how much information, but we it's highly unlikely that George has all this political shit figured out and a satisfying conclusion to even to the Battle of the Bastard and who's going to win and what's the aftermath going to be. And I think the Double D's are like, you know what? let's just pick a couple of houses to have name recognition, like the Umbers, and let's like put them on the one side, and we'll put the Umbers and Glovers there, and we'll put these other, you know, the Mormonts and others on Rob's side, and everyone's kind of heard of these names, right? Let's go with it. Like, I don't think the books are going to go anywhere close to how the Battle of the Bastards and the Northern campaign goes in the show. And I don't think the Double D's give a shit about the Umber status of fiercely loyal bannermen, and, you know, because they made that a whole point. Like, in the books, everybody in the North is like, if we can fucking kill some Boltons and Freys before we go out, before the winter, let's do it. I'd read, like, this, I forget the one guy who's in one of the Northern Mountain clans, and he's like, I'm not going to live through this winter. I want a guy going out bathing in Bolton blood, you know? And that's, like, the sentiment of the North. The fact that, like, the North would be torn, the loyalties between the Starks and the Boltons is horseshit.
Huh.
It's just utter horseshit.
Okay.
But what are you going to do? Like, who are you going to blame? The Double D's for writing some shit in 6 months, or Martin not finished in 9 years? I know who I blame. You have anything to add, Jim?
No.
All right. I feel like, so as long as it's spoiler stuff, I just rant like a madman.
Based on the books, too.
Yeah. All right, Fern from New York City. I was just looking for clarification on Jaime's status with the Kingsguard. Did he join willingly, or was he forced? In season one, when Tywin speaks to Jaime in the classic scene where Tywin's skinning that elk, he tells Jaime how he wasted his youth by being a bodyguard for a madman and a drunk. I took this to be that Jaime volunteered to be a Kingsguard, and Tywin was always upset about the decision. However, in the Game of Thrones Blu-ray extras, where Charles Dance narrates the story of the Lannisters, or history of the Lannisters, he says the Mad King, recognizing that Tywin was becoming powerful as the Hand of the King, and paranoid that Tywin might kill him to take power, forced Jaime to join the Kingsguard as insurance, and a message to Tywin that the Mad King had Jaime close to him as a hostage. If Tywin knows this, why would he blame Jaime for wasting away his life as in the Kingsguard? I can see why Jaime likes being a Kingsguard, because it lets him be with Cersei for his twincest fun, but it was forced upon him. What say you?
Yeah, that's weird, because I always got the same impression that,
right,
you know, he kind of chose that path.
What's super interesting is Tywin's giving you the Lannister history from his POV. And what's really interesting, like, that later books and, like, A History of the World and Fire lay out, is that a lot of the enmity between Tywin and Aerys was the result of misunderstandings. In reality, Cersei put Jaime up to joining the Kingsguard because she thought it'd be a swell way for him to be in King's Landing and be always right by her side for all their, like, you know, twincest love. And Tywin and Aerys was like, okay, well, whatever. But Tywin interpreted that as the power move that he... So when Charles Dance is reading this, this is entirely Tywin's analysis that is flawed, of what the Mad King was thinking and the machinations behind it. It was Cersei's entirely to blame for Jaime being the Kingsguard, because Jaime doesn't give a fuck. First of all, Jamie likes the Kingsguard, and he likes, like, he grew up romanticizing those stories, and those are the best swords, and it's the best sword. He's one of the best swords in the land. If he can be there and fuck his twin sister, then he's all on board. He doesn't give a shit about Casterly Rock or inherit. That seems boring as fuck. And you guys remember that Jamie's like a teenager at this time too.
Yeah.
So, like, everything we say about Rob and Danny goes double for him. So,
like,
that's
good that there's actually, like, a definitive answer for that, because I was hoping it wasn't just another situation of the Double D's and
no.
A hazy story.
That's like, in the early goings, there is everything, and I really appreciated the detail that Tywin Lannister is telling the history from his biased, imperfect point of view, where when you zoom up and the historians, like the maesters, are writing the story, they're like, well, you know, Aerys was kind of butthurt because he thought Tywin was a little late saving him from these raiders, and then there was, like, all these series of misunderstandings, and also Aerys was going crazy, so he got more and more paranoid, and things that he intended to be honors and boons were perceived as slights, and vice versa, and in fact, that sundered their relationship, because Tywin resigned as the Hand. And then took Cersei back to Casterly Rock, which separated the twins until she got married to Robert. So, like, that was maybe Cersei's first grand plan that blew up in her face. But it won't be the last. All right. Sean from North Kakalaki, which is that's what they called it. That's North Carolina. I don't know why North Carolina is called Kakalaki.
Okay.
I actually spent 5 minutes researching why, and I didn't come to a satisfying answer. So you North Kakalakians want to... Is it just like it's like why are Indiana people called Hoosiers?
Yeah.
There's like 5 or 6 different bullshit folk stories, but we just are. I'm hoping to attain your all thoughts about an idea I had while daydreaming in microbiology class today. The most common thought I've heard about
you shouldn't be daydreaming while you're in microbiology.
You should be studying microbiology, man. You're paying a lot for those classes.
Sure are.
The most common thought I had I've heard about the White Walkers is that they are a metaphor for climate change. I agree that this is a valid analysis, but I don't think it goes much further than the fact that the White Walker changes the weather and that the general population is ignoring this threat.
Yeah.
I think that, that's still a pretty good analogy. I think that another analogy can be made is that the White Walkers are comparable to an epidemic such as the Black Death. I personally think this metaphor fits more snug. First, as the Night King represents Patient Zero. For each other that he infects, whether another White Walker or a white, that individual now becomes a new vector to transmit the disease. After the long night, the White Walker disease slowly grew with help from Craster and the dead far north until reaching a large enough infected population to move into the general population of both the Wildlings and Westeros. To my knowledge, diseases were largely not understood in the Western world until the scientist known as the father of epidemiology studied the cholera outbreak in the 1850s and discovered the connection between human waste disposal and contaminated drinking water. The name of the scientist established a modern disease study. The father of epidemiology is Jon Snow. And
get out of here.
You know what's funny is, like, I think this came up in season 5 and we had the exact similar, like, floored reaction.
But okay.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true.
What a coincidence.
What a coincidence. Because I'm trying to think, and I apologize. I had a weird morning and I didn't get as much time to research as I usually do. But I want to say that, like, George is, like, maybe given 3 different things that the White Walkers could be allegories to, or maybe people have suggested to him. He's like, sure, whatever.
Yeah.
I've always thought that I know of recent years he's definitely seemed to be a fan of, like, the climate change thing. Is like, everyone's petty squabbling about stupid shit, essentially.
Yeah.
Marginal tax rates and whether men can get married to men and all this other stuff, and yet we have a true catastrophe that's slow moving out of our sight, like boiling a frog, and we're doing nothing about it until hopefully it's almost too late and not too late. But you know, I like that theory because every time I talk about it, I get a bunch of angry emails saying, "You stupid idiot, buying in his global," or, like, you know, proving my point. But yeah, Your idea's got a lot going for it. Number one, the Jon Snow theory. The Jon Snow connection is pretty fucking badass.
That seems pretty good.
And
also, I think it fits, you know, if not thematically, it certainly fits the setting a little bit better. That idea of like a black plague or a disease that they don't know how to treat. And then, you know, everybody knows that when you kill Patient Zero, all of its whites die with it.
Right.
So that just lines up perfectly.
Yeah. I don't know what Jon Snow had to say about that. if you find Typhoid Mary and you kill her, it just makes everything better.
Absolutely.
But to be honest, that's a show thing.
Right. That's not even the point. I'm kidding, obviously.
Right.
But I think setting-wise, it does fit pretty well.
Yeah. It's like, he outlined it perfectly. And, like, the idea that you could have an infection that you stamp out, but there's, like... Ebola's deep in the jungles, or did Africa even have jungles, or is that
deep into Serengeti,
they get bush meat? Like, there's these populations of monkeys that harbor it, and then every once in a while someone eats the wrong monkey and it bursts back out. Like, that's kind of fitting of, like, the long night. Like, you think you got it beat back and it's gone and everyone forgets and stops worrying about it, and suddenly shit, you know, people are getting sick and boarding planes and spreading around the world. So I've played Plague Inc. I've played Pandemic. I know how this shit works. And that's it. That is our podcast for today. If you would like to send in more of that there feedback, you can do so at gameofthrones@baldmove.com. Again, we have our forums. If you want to discuss some spoilers or non-spoiler stuff in our forum threads, you can do so. We will be back next week for episode 8. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.